am I to judge? From the moment Pope Francis uttered this line in a press conference on a return flight from his apostolic visit to Brazil in 2013, the media, and in consequence most people in the United States, I suppose, who don't normally spend their time closely parsing papal statements — there are a few people in the room, I think, who do, but most people do not — the media, and consequently many people, have taken it as a kind of summary of Pope Francis' whole approach to Christianity. As the New Yorker recently put it, "Who am I to judge?" has become a kind of totemic question, the mythic line of Pope Francis' pontificate. That description, that it's the mythic line, is, I think, quite apt, because there are a lot of myths floating out there about what the Pope was actually saying. So I'd like to begin by taking up that question and then moving from there to the question of politics and moral relativism. The words that most people have heard reported in the Pope's statement are generally incomplete and taken out of context. The Holy Father was expressly addressing the case of a person honestly trying to live according to the teachings of the Catholic Church, and he wasn't calling into question the Church's teaching. Nor has it mattered for most people or the media that the Vatican and even Pope Francis himself have repeatedly explained that he was only attempting to articulate what is found in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. In fact, generations of Catholics, and I imagine many in this room, have long proclaimed exactly what Pope Francis was saying in that statement, although formulated slightly differently: love the sinner and condemn the sin. Here's how the Holy Father explained this in his recent book, In the Name of God is Mercy, which is really an interview with an Italian journalist. The Holy Father says this: "The Church condemns sin because it has to relay the truth. This is a sin. But at the same time, it embraces the sinner who recognizes himself as such. It welcomes him. It speaks to him of the infinite mercy of God." This is quite simply classic Catholic teaching, and it probably doesn't sound much like what you've probably heard the media reporting Pope Francis to have been saying. In fact, we could even quote St. Thomas Aquinas, who, as a Dominican, I love to refer to, and as a member of the Thomistic Institute, it's entirely fitting that we would bring the angelic doctor, St. Thomas, to bear on this point. Aquinas teaches that we can judge what we see, and what we see is an action, perhaps a sin. But we should not presume to judge what we cannot see, the secrets of our neighbor's heart. Rather, we should always presume the best of our neighbor, we should love him, and we should desire his good and ultimately his salvation. In fact, Aquinas goes even further than this. Listen to this very interesting quotation from Aquinas about judging. He writes this in his Summa Theologiae: "It must be said that it is one thing to judge about things. It is another to judge about persons. For in making a judgment about things, we can do neither good nor evil to the thing about which we judge. But when we make a judgment about persons, we can indeed do good or evil to the person we judge, because we will honor a person we judge to be good, and we will consider a person we judge to be evil to be worthy of contempt. For this reason, we ought to aim at judging a person to be good, unless there is evident proof to the contrary. It may happen that one who interprets doubtful matters for the best is more frequently deceived." This is actually a big deal for Aquinas, because he thinks it's very important that we know the truth. But he says it's better to let ourselves be deceived. "It is better to err frequently by having a good opinion of a bad person than to err occasionally by having a bad opinion of a good person, because in the latter case, an injury is inflicted." In fact, there are two important distinctions that Aquinas wants to draw on when he talks about making judgments, and they are very helpful in our contemporary context when people hear talk about making moral judgments, and many people become very nervous or skittish about saying anything that seems to imply a judgment of another person. The distinctions are these. That first, we judge primarily things about which we can really accurately assess, and not the interior motives of persons. We don't judge people. That's really God's place. The second distinction, which Aquinas doesn't talk so much about in the text I've just read you, is between something that is objectively wrong, an objectively wrong action, you might say the moral principles that are at stake, and the subjective culpability of the person who is acting. So, for example, there are cases where someone might be ignorant of the wrong he's committing or she's committing, and that isn't necessarily a morally culpable action. Simple case that often you hear quoted, if you take a moral theology class with a Thomist, for example, perhaps there are some of you here who've done that or who would like to do that. We'd love to have you at the Divinity Council Studies. A hunter who hears and sees something moving in the bushes and fires, thinking he's shooting a deer, and then discovering he's just shot another person. Now, that would be murder, except that he wasn't intending to kill. So there you have a morally wrong action. I mean, the objective act is bad, but you don't have necessarily subjective culpability for the action. And there are many other examples we could give. Well, this initial reflection about judging and making sense of what Pope Francis said leads us, I think, to another question. Why has this totemic question, this mythic line, had such resonance in our culture? I suspect most of us could give a pretty good answer to that question. Being judgmental is the unforgivable sin of our age. And this is really felt in a particularly acute way by younger generations who have been pickled, as it were, in a pervasive and public moral relativism for most of their lives. It's what is preached on the secular media, is what is inculcated in grade schools and high schools and certainly on university campuses. And so anyone who teaches, I taught for a couple years at Providence College, where we have some very fine students. I'm sure students at Hillsdale are also just as fine as the students at Providence College. Providence College is run by the Dominicans, so I have to get a little plug there. But even there, I would sometimes encounter a student who would pose an objection like this. Father, what you're saying is true for you, but not for me. For a college teacher, especially if you're teaching in philosophy or theology or elsewhere in the humanities, this is one of the most serious challenges to teaching undergraduates. It's a challenge first on the theoretical level, because if you don't get clear about this, you can't make any progress in any of the rest of the things you want to talk about. And secondly, because it is so close to the hearts of so many young people. And so you've got to find a way to articulate a theory of moral truth that they can accept without feeling themselves like they're put in a vice. In fact, relativism today comes in a whole range of varieties, all of which I think can be found on most contemporary college campuses, and you could probably tick off a few more, but to just highlight the principal ones that you've, I'm sure, encountered, you have claims to cultural relativism, or historical relativism, or linguistic relativism. Legal positivism, which can be, in an extreme form, a kind of legal relativism. So what do these relativisms teach? How do they actually formulate what they hold out? They would say things like, right and wrong depends on what the law says, what the positive law has enacted, and that's all. There's no standard of right and wrong beyond what the positive law has stated. That's a kind of strong form of legal positivism. Or, right and wrong depends on what the dominant culture says, or what the crowd says. And in fact, there's no standard of right and wrong that transcends your culture. That's a kind of cultural relativism. Or right and wrong depends on what the mores of a certain historical period say. So what people thought was wrong in the 18th century, we now see is right. Or what people thought was right in the 18th century, we now see is wrong. And so this is supposedly evidence for the fact that there are no transcendent claims to moral right and wrongness. All of these forms of relativism share in common the claim that there is no unchanging, non-arbitrary standard of right and wrong. They would say that all such claims are relative to culture, to historical context, to language, to legal regime, and so forth. So what is right in one culture or one period is not necessarily right and true in another. Now, this poses a fundamental challenge to teaching in a university. It also poses a fundamental challenge to our whole culture and to our political culture in particular. And that's where I'd like to go in just a minute. But before we get to talking about politics, I'd like to talk about just the challenge that this poses for our own understanding of the world around us. In fact, our understanding of right and wrong. Why are claims that there is an objective moral right and wrong so intimidating? Generally, people have no problem admitting that there are scientific facts that are certainly true, always true. That doesn't seem to pose a danger to us, although there are some who make very strong claims of sort of theoretical relativism, even about every form of truth. But it seems to me that most people today are frightened of claims about moral truth because they don't want to appear judgmental or intolerant. Or they may not know how to affirm moral standards without judging others, without appearing to be condemning others. Those are probably the first two reasons that we could enumerate. I think there's a third that we shouldn't discount, and which often is very psychologically powerful, that when we recognize that there are moral claims out there that could make a demand on me, well, I may not want to confront the truth about myself. And often on college campuses, you have the situation where students are, they may have been raised in a very good family, they may go off to college with all the best intentions, and then away from the constraints of their peers and their families, they begin doing things that they wouldn't do at home, and then they begin thinking things that they wouldn't think at home because they cannot confront the possibility that I have done something wrong. Psychologically, I think this is a major factor and one that we shouldn't discount, and one that certainly in teaching to young people and ministering to them, we always have to keep in mind. So what kind of answer can we make to relativism? It's my contention, now we could actually talk about relativism in general, but speaking more specifically about moral relativism and setting aside abstract theoretical arguments about it, I think we can make the case, I would like to make the case, that there really is no true moral relativism in practice. In fact, if you look at the principles that Aquinas lays out for moral action, he would say that it's metaphysically impossible to claim that there is no such a thing as a good for me. That this is part of the structure of human action. That every person is always aiming for the good insofar as he or she understands it. Now, of course, we'd have to add a lot of qualifications there, because if you teach this in a college classroom, the first objection that you get is, there are some people who aim at evil things. And that is true, they aim at evil things, but Aquinas' point is that they never aim at something as evil for its own sake. They are always aiming at something desirable, but not a fitting good or a disordered good. Think about, we were talking about this just before the lecture, think about Michael Corleone in The Godfather. Good guy at the beginning of the movie. In fact, what you see in the course of those the first two films, and I don't recommend watching the third one, which I had the misfortune of watching just recently for the first time. I could not believe how poorly the series ended. I mean, George Lucas should have learned something from that series when he went to make the second set of Star Wars movies. But in any case, the first two Godfather movies are this very interesting portrayal of a good guy who goes terribly wrong, and it just keeps getting worse until he ends up betraying the very things that he set out to protect, his family. But he begins by seeking a good. Now, he's using the wrong means. He's using evil means, but he wants to protect his father. He wants to protect his family. He wants to win the esteem of others. He's even fighting against a drug dealer who wants to do drugs to sell drugs to young children. So in a certain sense, there are goods that he's pursuing, but pursuing the wrong goods or in the wrong way can produce real evil. And that is what evil is. Evil is not a positive thing. Evil is the absence of a thing. And consequently, it's not possible to desire a nothing. You always have to desire a something, and there can be something unfitting about that, but you can't desire evil directly. Okay, I wasn't intending to talk about that, but that is in fact, at the metaphysical level, that is Aquinas' deepest explanation for the problem with moral relativism. Because everyone will always have to behave by orienting themselves to something they think that is good. And they will make claims about that good, even with respect to other people. So, if we look at the practical sphere and the way relativism works out in our own culture, so theoretical relativism, how does it get translated into action in our own culture, we find, in fact, all kinds of judgments being made. Judgments that are, in fact, moral judgments, but that are camouflage moral judgments. So, if you just think about the law makes judgments all the time. In fact, it's hard to come up with an example of a law that doesn't make judgments. If you think about the criminal law, we have laws that prevent you from killing another person. If you do that, you'll be punished quite severely. And why are you punished? Not only because you will harm other people, but because it is considered wrong to do this. Even when we talk about something like environmental regulations, something that we might say is a purely factual statement, like throwing away huge volumes of plastic is bad for the environment, or certain types of carbon emissions are bad for the environment, even a statement like that already contains within it an implicit judgment that we shouldn't do that. And isn't it true that we make moral judgments about polluters? And our culture celebrates making moral judgments about polluters. When I moved from California to New Haven, where I was going to law school, I mean, I'd been soaking in the recycling culture at Claremont McKenna College for 4 years. And we always had two bins. You know, you had the trash bin and the recycling bin. And I moved to New Haven, and I walked around the dormitory and said, "Where's the recycling bin?" And they said, "There is no recycling bin. You have to throw your cans in the trash, your aluminum cans." I felt so guilty doing that. It makes sense that you would feel guilty about that if you think that recycling is good and not recycling is bad. Those are judgments that are being made, and we think that they are just about, say, a scientific fact. But in fact, they are camouflaging a moral judgment. There aren't any practical relativists. They're always hiding some moral judgment. Think about some other historical examples. The American Civil Rights Movement, the great achievements of Martin Luther King Jr. This was a case where there was real injustice in the United States. And Martin Luther King is rightly celebrated as having won a great triumph for justice. It's a moral accomplishment that we are proud of in our country. And this is why we erect monuments on the National Mall. Do we want to hang the hook of that accomplishment on moral relativism? If we do, then we are allowing the possibility that a future generation will come along and say, that was true then, but we now think racial discrimination is a good thing, and we want to do away with all these laws that prevent racial discrimination. Martin Luther King was living in a time when there were a lot of people who thought that racial discrimination was perfectly fine. Think about Birmingham in 1963. In Birmingham in 1963, it was legal to segregate. And Martin Luther King said, I don't care what the law is. I don't care what the Constitution says. The Constitution, at that point, had not been interpreted to outlaw segregation in public accommodations, only in public schools. I don't care if a majority of the people of the state say that this is good. It is unjust, and I am going to fight against it. It's a very nice example of why legal positivistic relativism doesn't work, of why historical relativism doesn't work, why cultural relativism doesn't work, because we think it's good to critique a culture that has bad moral norms, and some of them do. The very fact that someone is able to lodge a cultural critique of his or her own culture is evidence that our thinking about right and wrong is not purely conditioned by our culture. In other words, you have to be able to stand outside of your culture somehow and have some standard by which to judge it if you are going to try to challenge your culture. And isn't that the story of America? Don't we have, we could list a whole list of figures who have done things like that. And we still think it's important to do things like that. And people on the left and the right agree that we should do things like that. In fact, this all implies making a moral judgment. So, what about the question of politics? If you hold that politics, if you hold more a moral relativistic position, it is disastrous for politics. Now, I've been saying that there aren't really any practical relativists, but there are lots of theoretical relativists out there. And they're speaking the language of relativism and camouflaging the judgments that they're making. This is very bad for a political system. Why? The classical understanding of politics is that it is a deliberation over the common good. It is coming together to seek, as a community, what is the good of the community, and in fact, to reason about that good. That's the way the ancients understood politics. Now, of course, it involves taking account of your view and my view, and we have to work this out. But it is a reasoned deliberation, and it presupposes that there is a real good, a good that we can talk about, a good that is in some sense objective, a good of the human person, a good of the human family, a good of the human society, a good of our particular community. If we accept the public theoretical discourse of moral relativism, if we buy what we're being sold, the language of relativism as the normative language for our public political discourse, which we largely have done, I'm afraid, then the real moral judgments that underlie political claims become hidden from view, and politics becomes an exercise of will and of power, and not of reason. I try to obtain what I think is in my interest for myself. There's no more deliberation over the common good, because it's not even clear that we can talk about there being a common good that is really good for all of us. And here, Pope John Paul II, I think, is wonderfully clear and quite prophetic. Writing in the encyclical Veritatis Splendor, you can hear John Paul drawing on his experience in totalitarian Germany. He was a young man in Poland occupied by the Nazis. and then Poland occupied by the Soviet communists, and then Poland with a communist regime over him. So he knows a little bit about totalitarianism, existentially. And this is his diagnosis of the roots of totalitarianism in Veritatis Splendor. Listen to this quotation. "Totalitarianism arises out of a denial of truth in the objective sense. If there is no transcendent truth, in obedience to which man achieves his full identity, then there is no sure principle for guaranteeing just relations between people. Their self-interest as a class, group, or nation would inevitably set them in opposition to one another. There's no common good there, in other words. If one does not acknowledge transcendent truth, then the force of power takes over, and each person tends to make full use of the means at his disposal in order to impose his own interests or his own opinion, with no regard for the rights of others." John Paul goes on to make this the foundation for an appeal for the protection of fundamental human rights. Why? The positive law can never act against the fundamental rights based on the intrinsic dignity of the human person that each human person enjoys. I think that is a sort of chilling quotation for us when we realize just how far our public discourse has gone in the direction of accepting relativism as sort of the coin of the realm, and consequently our politics becoming not a deliberation about the common good, but a search for power, a search to get my party interest or my sectional interest to obtain that at the expense of others. I'd like to finish by simply noting what the context that St. Thomas Aquinas puts this search for truth, for moral truth, in. He comments on John 8. "If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." The truth will make you free. It's a great thing to be a disciple of Christ, St. Thomas writes. And to know the truth is the goal of a disciple. A disciple literally means a student, a learner. And the Lord gives this to those who believe. You will know the truth. "Yet," says Aquinas, "the greatest thing is the acquisition of freedom, which the knowledge of truth produces in those who believe." In this context, to be free does not mean to be released from some bonds or chains, but rather being made free from three things: the error of falsity, slavery to sin, and slavery to corruption and death, which Jesus gives us a remedy for. So ultimately, for Aquinas, being truly free has a lot to do with acknowledging the truth. And just as we were created to know the reality around us, so the truth is the path to the real human good. May our culture recognize the need for this truth, that we would remain free. Thank you. So Dr. Spaulding has arranged for a couple microphones for questions, if there are some questions. Yes. Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I've never really thought about that. So I don't know the text. So you're referring to the preamble to the Constitution to secure the common welfare. I think that's a functional equivalent to common good. So I do think that that was, in the minds of the founding generation, This was an important part of political deliberation, was a search for the common good. And, I mean, certainly a clear-eyed recognition of the danger that self-interest would play. I mean, in the Federalist Papers, we get the marvelous sort of remedy. If men were angels, you know, we wouldn't need these remedies. But because they will seek their self-interest, we need to do something to try and safeguard what? Not just, I mean, there would be no point to talking about expanding the sphere of government so that we can kind of cancel out self-interest if they thought that politics was nothing more than self-interest. So they do think that self-interest is always going to be at play in political questions, but that really the aim of politics is the common good.
So a moral relativist position really works against the constitutional...
Oh, I think absolutely, yeah. I don't think our founding generation were moral relativists, no. Yes?
There's a trend of put in some of the left, or I guess you'd say left.
So the right in
black
circles.
Can you ever hear?
No,
what I was going to say is that there's a motif that shows up in some of the intellectual circles around centering on the value system around human flourishing. I wonder if you counter that comment on it, if you would.
Well, actually, that's, I mean, they're stealing our language when they talk about that. So for Thomas Aquinas, this is, and not just Thomas Aquinas, but the whole classical moral Christian moral tradition, if you go back to St. Augustine, for example, it's morality is understood in these terms of human flourishing. Now, human flourishing understood in an objective sense, that is, what is the good of the human person? So, morality, some people are very surprised to hear this, but for Aquinas or for St. Augustine, morality is not a list of rules. It's not about the rules and commandments and what happens to you if you break them. Morality is principally about what is the perfect happiness for man, what is the perfect good for human beings, and then how do they get there? And sin is always going to interrupt and distort and destroy that good. So that's how you fit sin into this picture of human flourishing. But that is a classic way to think about moral questions and even, I think, the common good. So, you know, what is good for human beings? That's the way John Paul analyzes the common good. It's also the way Aquinas would analyze it. Yes?
What would you say would be some practical steps that we can take to reform culture in a world where, as Justice Scalia says, words have no meaning to some of the justices, or when we're in the legislature, you can completely and utterly deny the life of a very human being? What are some practical steps to combat against the vehement opposition of the will against wanting to know the truth in the first place?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, you know, bringing, simply exposing, like among our friends, the fact that all of these, that in fact judgments are being made all the time. It's inevitable that there are going to be judgments made, and we have to do it, and it's good for us to do it as long as we do it in the right way. Now, adding the two caveats that I started with, we should judge things or actions rather than persons, and we should distinguish between the objective wrong of something and subjective culpability. A lot of students I've found, you know, they have real heartburn about making judgments until you give them those distinctions. And then they say, oh, good, okay, I can actually say that this act is wrong, but I don't have to judge the person or condemn the person. And that's very important. I mean, so I would say that's really the place to begin. And then when you can expose the judgments that are being made in the background, you can start to identify, you know, the root of the problem. Yes.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. I'm curious how you would approach a situation where two opposing sides aren't necessarily between a morally relativistic point of view and one that believes in absolute truth, but rather two contradicting opinions of absolute truth. For example, it seems to me that with the same-sex marriage debate, we sort of moved away from well, you do your thing, I'll do my thing, you do what's good for you, this is what's good for me, to the proponents of same-sex marriage making much more of an argument, and to Martin Luther Jr. saying, this is what's right, and if you say anything, like, this is morally compelling that we must affirm this, because it, otherwise it would violate the absolute truth of equality.
That's a great question, and I think actually I'd like to say that there are sort of two, well, there are 2 points to my response. Whether there's 2 points in your question, I'll leave for you to decide. Who am I to judge? and that would be this, that I don't think it's possible to avoid sometimes having those conflicts and those debates. And in fact, that's a good sign when we really have a robust debate about some substantive matter. I mean, politics is always going to involve some measure of debate over things like that. It might be about something trivial, like should we build this bridge, should we build a 4-lane bridge or a 6-lane bridge here? Or should it have a carpool lane or should it have a bike lane? You know, how do we trade off the decision between those two? So that's normal, and it's normal that we would have differences of opinion. And you can imagine how people would turn that into a moral imperative, right? Well, cyclists are morally superior people, you know, to drivers. And so we, all those drivers, I mean, I'm from Seattle. People make that kind of argument. Okay, so there's that question. I don't think it's avoidable. I think you will have conflicts. Now, what kind of conflict do you have? Sometimes these disagreements about values, you know, like, well, I have my values and you have yours, it may be premised on a kind of explicit relativism. It also might just be basing itself on a kind of emotivism where, like, I feel so strongly that this is true, and that is the basis for my opposition, and you don't have access to my feelings. So, you know, we're sort of at an impasse. You feel differently, but I feel this way. Okay, what you probably already now can see the problem there. The problem is that we've now made the basis for making a moral claim just the way I feel about it. It's an emotivist claim. And we could go into a critique of emotivism, but basically the idea is that we want to talk about the objective reality that is accessible to us, like accessible to me, accessible to you. We can have a rational conversation about it. And the way we feel about it should not be the ultimate measure of whether something is right or wrong. I mean, I give you this advice as a Catholic priest. Feelings can be a very unreliable guide to a moral action. How can it be wrong when it feels so right? You know? Well, sometimes it can be wrong. So you don't just do what you have to think about what is right. And this is a part, for Aristotle, this was a very important part of being morally well-educated. Being morally well-formed for Aristotle meant that you could govern your feelings or your passions by your reason. Reason was in the driver's seat, not those passions. Now, we are often surrounded by people who've never even heard of that kind of thing, and for whom, like, emotivist language is just the first thing that you resort to. I mean, I imagine that most comment boxes on the internet, you know, are some kind of emotivist, you know, you see a lot of emotion there, certainly. But reasoned deliberation, that's what we're after. And in principle, we should be able together to have some access to reality around us. Aquinas would certainly make that claim. And to making some judgments about what is good. Now, inevitably, it will become more difficult to make strong claims about what is good the more particular we make things. So if you talk about the natural law for Aquinas, he would say, well, we know some things, the general principles, with a high degree of clarity. But as you descend into particular things, it gets actually rather debatable. And, you know, reasonable people can disagree, and it depends on the circumstances, and it requires a prudent person to judge under the circumstances what is right or what is wrong. Yes?
Leaving aside the objective moral scandal of your failure to recycle, this is going to sound a little judgy. I feel that it's judgy, but I hope it's not. The dichotomy between judging acts and judging people, I wanted to ask you to take that and apply it to the current situation we're in, which is discerning a candidate for the presidency of the United States. And I think about this. How do I judge a candidate as qualified under that rubric of acts versus persons? Because it certainly feels like I'm judging a person, that that person is bad or unfit for office. That person might be a tyrant. Have tendencies there too. I'm just curious if you could elaborate and sort of expand upon our citizenly duty to select people for high office.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. So if I can try and be a mouthpiece for Aquinas, what I think Aquinas would say, although he did not live in a democracy or a democrat, I mean, he didn't imagine a democratic system, although the Dominican order is a very democratic order, so I should add that as a little, you know, from the 13th century, 800 years, we're celebrating 800 years this year, and we elect our superiors, so there is a kind of, I mean, there is in the Dominican order some reflection on, is this man suitable or not suitable for office? I think Aquinas would say, you talk about what is the suitability for holding this office. You don't necessarily make a moral judgment of his moral standing before God or what is in his heart. So you do have to, I mean, you can look at a person and make a judgment based on the assessment, you know, the evidence that you have before you. And sometimes you do have to do that. But I think he would distinguish that from making a judgment about what you cannot see in the person. I'm pretty sure it's not historical, but it's a nice story about Aquinas that was written in a hagiographical account of him, that he was teaching one day, and one of the brothers, to tease him, said, "Look out the window, there's a flying cow." And Aquinas got up from his place and went to look out the window, and the other brothers laughed. And he came back and he said, "I would rather believe that a cow could fly than that one of my brothers would lie to me." So it's an example of, really always taking the best possible interpretation of what someone's actually doing. But I don't think we have to be naive about, your job as a voter is to pick the candidate that you think will best serve the common good. And I don't think you have to be naive about what you think a person may or may not do. Yes? Yes, this gentleman. Or if you want to just stand up and... Yeah, that's an excellent question, because really now you're adding into the mix the question of faith. So if somebody has a particular religious belief or holds a position because of something divinely revealed, is that something you can legitimately bring into public deliberation or public discourse? So it's slightly different than just a pure moral relativism claim, because you could say, oh yes, I know that there are moral truths, and I know that just from like looking at the world around me, not based on some religious truth. Or some not making a claim based on revelation, but for Aquinas, there certainly is a unity between the truth. The truth is one. God is the author of our capacity to know the world, our capacity of reason. He's also the author of divine revelation, and so Aquinas thinks there's never going to be any conflict between those two, and so there will always be a harmony between what God reveals and what can be publicly known. Now we may not be able to figure out everything that God has revealed from just looking at the world around us by our natural reason. Aquinas certainly thinks that we can't. There are lots of things that we won't know that God reveals. But he doesn't think that these are different sorts of truth They're both true. They're just known in a different way. So it would be perfectly legitimate for a citizen to take into account or to publicly advocate for something based on divine revelation. You know, God says that we should rest on Sunday, and therefore we should not allow stores to be open on Sunday. To give an example, I was just living over in Switzerland. In Switzerland, all the stores are closed on Sunday. And after 3.5 years living there, I came back here to Washington. I was driving someplace past a Target, and there was a line of cars to get into the Target on 14th Street. You know, there can be some time. And I thought, how barbaric. This is barbarism. Now, that's, so maybe I was culturally conditioned by my time in Switzerland to think of that. But in fact, I think that's a legitimate thing to have a public debate about, that we could consecrate a day that would be free of commerce for the good of citizens worshiping their creator, for the good of families being together. I don't think that, certainly in the history of the United States, we've had lots of laws like that. Maybe I could provoke a much bigger discussion about church-state relations and so forth. There's a lot more distinctions that would need to be made there, I suppose. But I don't think it's just out of court. Yes? Okay.
This was a question that comes to mind. So much gets placed in terms of discussing whether something is constitutional or not, with a lot of twisting of language or saying what these terms mean, without referring to the very strong philosophical principles set out in the Declaration of Independence. You said that there's self-evident truths. You know, man is endowed by his creator with certain inalienable rights. How did we sort of set those things aside, and how can we reclaim that?
Well, the history of that, there are people in the room who are much more competent to answer the history to that. But I would say, you know, there has been, dating back into the 19th century at least, there's been a very intentional effort to relativize those claims made in the Declaration of Independence, which are not very up to date. You know, we have a kind of 19th century theory of the progression of history, or 18th century idea of the progression of history, that would say, well, after a certain number of generations passes away, we need to move on, move forward. And the progressive movement very explicitly intended to recast the way we think about American government, to get away from those ideas from the 18th century. And I think that's been very bad for our political discourse. But more than that, I will reserve for another occasion at Hillsdale College. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Father Dominic, for that amazing lecture, and thank you to all of you for coming to the inaugural lecture of the Thomistic Institute Capitol Hill chapter. So at Hillsdale College and the Kirby Center, we like founding, so you've been present for a sort of founding tonight. So thank you very much. The chapter's mission is to encourage a robust discussion, especially in the young adult community, whether on the Hill or elsewhere, about first principles. In light of the Western philosophical heritage, focusing, as you might have guessed, in particular on the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas and its application to modern-day problems. So as you heard earlier, we are sponsoring a series of lectures here at Kirby. This was the first of them. There are two more, and you can see the dates for those on the little placeholder on your chair there. The next one is on February 23rd, and we hope to see you all there. In April, we'll also be hosting a talk about Aquinas' thoughts on the nature of beauty at St. Charles Borromeo Parish in Arlington. And in the fall, we'll be launching an exciting series on human person, so exploring questions like what is man, what is human virtue, what is human happiness, and what is the role of friendship in the well-ordered political society. So, as I said, the next lecture's here on the 23rd. We hope to see you all then. Beatrice, could you wave for a moment? Everyone turn around, say hi to Beatrice. If you'd like information to get our emails about future events, please see Beatrice in the back. She has sign-up forms, and she'll be at a table in the other room there. And again, thank you for joining us. Without further ado, please everyone adjourn to the back there for drinks and food. Thank you.
If I can make one final plug, the Thomistic Institute has partnered with Clooney Media to publish some classic Dominican works of theology and spirituality and philosophy. And we have the first two books in that series, so it's an imprint of the Thomistic Institute, available in the lobby for purchase. So John Clark will be out there selling the books, and I heartily recommend the books that we have there. Thank you very much.